Okay, let's try this. So we were starting to talk about dielectrics and how to treat boundary value problems involving dielectrics. And the first example I worked out last time was one of the very few, again, that you can solve with image charges. And here's the second category of problems. I called it in the notes category two. Problems with dielectrics that we can solve as a boundary value problem, solving the PDE more or less directly and imposing the relevant boundary conditions. And we'll treat this by separation of variables. And the specific example I want to solve is to, it's actually a fairly important problem that'll have some implications. We'll take a dielectric sphere, which is made of some, well, it has some radius, and it's made of some dielectric constant epsilon. And outside, we'll say there is the free space dielectric constant, epsilon naught. And we're going to place it in an external electric field. We'll choose its axis of the field to be, define our z-axis. So that then we have azimuthal symmetry, right, around this axis. And also there are no free charges in this problem. I think I called it rho free in the earlier discussion, and Jackson just calls it rho. And so we can, this is a problem we can solve using potential methods, right? There will be a phi inside and a phi outside. We're going to try to calculate. The phi inside we'll write as a sum over, we can use the Legendre polynomial expansion because we have azimuthal symmetry, some unknown constants AL, R to the L, PL cos theta. Right? We're talking about an observation point, right? And then there'll be a phi out side of the sphere, which is also a sum over L. Whereas we couldn't have any terms R to the minus L minus 1 inside because they would be divergent at the origin, which is unacceptable. In the outside region, we will consider the most general solution, include terms that actually do diverge at infinity, because we'll see we will need one of those, and another with terms that fall off at infinity, and a Legendre polynomial. So we're basically starting with the separated solutions in spherical coordinates we had found before. And now we try to match the different regions by applying the boundary conditions that are appropriate. So let's look at the boundary conditions. First of all, to represent the external electric field, we know that far away from the dielectric, whatever its effect is of the field on the dielectric, which is going to tend to polarize the charges in the material, right? It's going to tend to make positive charges line up a little bit more to the right and negative charges a little bit more to the left. If this is a positive electric field directed in the positive z-axis direction, that's physically what's going on. It's rearranging the charges a little bit, the dipoles in the material. But at infinity, those effects will die off, and they won't be felt as you go to infinity. So we can go ahead and demand that the limit as r goes to infinity of phi out has to be the function whose gradient, negative gradient, gives the electric field at infinity, which is this electrostatic potential. Recasting it in this notation, right? What is this? We all remember. This is just E naught R cos theta, which is P1 of cos theta. So, in fact, we know there has to be, that tells us exactly what B1 is, actually, right now. This first boundary condition, B1 has to be minus E naught, but all other BL, L greater than 1, are 0. Actually, I should say not equal to 1, because we don't want a constant at infinity. In addition, usually you would choose the field to be 0, the potential to be 0 at infinity due to finite charges. So I'll leave that constant off and say even L equals 0. Okay, second boundary condition. E parallel at the surface everywhere is continuous. That was one of the boundary conditions we derived for a surface between two different dielectric media. So we can calculate that as the derivative here will be the theta derivative, basically. More precisely, 1 over r d phi n d theta at r equals a has to equal minus 1 over r d phi out d theta at r equals a. Remember, E is still minus del phi, even when we have dielectric. I should have mentioned that. Okay, so if L is not equal to 1, then the BL is already 0, we've shown. So we have AL, A to the L, must equal CL, A to the minus L minus 1, for all L not equal to 1. Right, because these are, for the derivatives in theta to be equal, we'll have to have the constants in front of the PL equal. for L equals one, on the other hand, we'll have A one A plus, equals B one A plus C one over A squared. We'll demand that. And final boundary condition we need is that D dot M hat, right, is continuous at the surface, since there are no free charges in this universe. So the normal is, of course, the radial component. So that means epsilon E is D, our electric displacement. So epsilon E perpendicular in, meaning the radial component, is equal to epsilon naught E perpendicular outside. Or in math terms, in terms of our potential solution, that means minus epsilon d phi n dr at r equals a has to equal minus epsilon naught d phi out dr at r equals a. So I can go ahead and do those differentiations, and that says for L not equal to 1, minus epsilon L AL A to the L minus 1 from the radial derivative is equal to minus epsilon naught minus L minus 1 CL A to the minus L minus 2. And for L equal 1, minus epsilon A1 must equal minus epsilon naught times minus E naught plus twice C1 over A squared. So basically, for each L, we have two equations and two unknowns. Interestingly, for L not equal to 1, let's look at those cases first. We have this equation that only has AL and CL and no other terms, and this equation, which has AL and CL and no other terms. Now, these are two homogeneous linear equations. When you see two equations and two unknowns and they're linear, first thing should come into your head is, are they homogeneous or inhomogeneous? Do you know the difference?
Say again, sorry.
Do you know the difference between homogeneous?
Homogeneous is it equals zero.
Or inhomogeneous?
And inhomogeneous is it can't equal zero?
Right. So what's true about homogeneous linear equations is they only possess a solution if the determinant of coefficients is zero. I'm not going to calculate the determinant, but you could quickly do that with these two equations, and you'll see the determinant is not zero. And so that means the only solution when L is different from 1 has the trivial solution. Okay, inhomogeneous solutions are the opposite. They only have a solution if the determinant of coefficients is not zero. And here it's not. You can solve these two equations and two unknowns. I'll spare you the algebra. A1 is minus 3E0 over 2 plus epsilon over epsilon naught. And C1 is epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1 over epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2 A cubed E0. So I can write the final solution. It's actually very simple. It's even going to be a finite series. It's not infinite. We'll have a closed form solution, which is a nice result when you started out thinking you're going to maybe have to deal with an infinite series. So phi n, function of r and theta, and then of course it's independent of the azimuthal phi coordinate. And phi out. So again, that's solution for the potential at r less than a, and phi out has the asymptotic part from the externally applied electric field. And then there is a term that falls off, which is due to the polarized charges in the sphere that looks like epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1, epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2, E naught, A cubed over R squared, cos theta. So that's the electrostatic potential at R greater than A. And one interesting thing I don't think I had time to point out last time is that notice that none of our boundary conditions said that phi is continuous. We had a phi continuous boundary condition when there were no dielectrics in chapters 2 and 3. But here we had other boundary conditions. Parallel component of E is continuous, and the normal component of D is continuous if there are no free charges. It turns out that these basically imply that phi is continuous too. So sometimes people use that as a condition when they solve problems like that. You can actually do that, apply that as well. But let's look at the electric field. I think that's instructive. So we'll have to take the negative gradient of our phi. This recording thing is actually working. Maybe. So E inside, we take the gradient of our inside expression, works to be 3 over epsilon over epsilon naught plus two E naught Z hat. So if we have a normal dielectric, epsilon over epsilon naught will be a number greater than one, typically. That means the electric field inside has been reduced from what it would be if there was no dielectric. That's still in the same direction as we kind of expect by symmetry. Why does that make sense? Well, you can see an electric field due to charges that have piled up a little on this side and negatives on this side, that's going to tend to add a counter electric field from these charges that have been redistributed. So that's why it is reduced inside. And what about outside? Field outside still has the external field term, but there is a second term that turns out to be exactly the electric field due to a permanent dipole. So in particular, if you look at our formulas earlier in the chapter for the electric field due to a point dipole, if the magnitude of the dipole, the point dipole, dipole moment is, of course, its direction is in the z direction. If its magnitude is 4 pi epsilon naught times this epsilon naught minus 1 over epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2 a cubed e0, this will give plug that into the formula for the electric field of a dipole, it gives exactly this this expression from taking the negative gradient of that, namely, and the effective total dipole moment of the sphere, should say one way to calculate it, is to simply integrate d cubed x over the polarization per unit volume of the sphere. That's the vector we call this capital P. And in our problem, this was 4 pi epsilon naught, this epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1, epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2, a cubed e0. Zeta. Another expression for this P of X is epsilon minus epsilon naught times the electric field, which is this 3 epsilon naught, epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1, where epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2, E0. So let's see, what did I want to say about this? Let's just write a couple of forms for this electric field outside. It's kind of interesting.
For E outside, is it supposed to be negative dipole moment?
Yeah.
Sorry, what?
For E outside, it's equals E naught Z plus.
This equation?
Yeah. Shouldn't that be negative? A partly because phi out is negative ER plus that. The other thing is we said that E outside should be smaller than normal because there's the dipole moment.
You're thinking of the negative gradient. Of course, d by dr of this will be negative.
There we go.
So I don't think.
No, I think you're right because of that.
Yeah.
So when epsilon is equal to epsilon naught, the polarization term vanishes.
Right.
Can't we think of like a hypothetical sphere with the same epsilon naught with the free space that like a cavity that contains the charges like we have here and still have polarizability?
You think, okay, so we have vacuum here, we have vacuum here, or a material that happens to have epsilon naught.
Yeah.
And you're thinking something will happen? That's not just free space everywhere?
And we have the electric field.
And then we have an electric field. What do you think will happen? I mean, the boundary conditions are such that this behaves exactly as if there's no boundary. If these have the same dielectric constant. So I don't see that anything happens. You just get E is E naught Z at everywhere. You don't like that. You think you could polarize the vacuum?
I mean, assuming there are charges in the vacuum.
There are no charges in this whole problem.
Okay.
This entire problem has no charges.
Okay. I see.
And if you want to solve a problem with charges, we'll have to solve it. But we have that can't use the math we've developed here.
Okay.
Okay. Okay, to see this more directly, let's look at these other more explicit formulas for the electric field. We've got the E naught Z hat, of course. And now we have minus epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1 epsilon over epsilon naught plus 2 E naught A cubed. And then the gradient of cos theta over r squared. That gradient's going to have two terms, of course. And so this will look like E naught Z hat minus this epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1 over epsilon naught plus 2. E naught A cubed, and now the gradient terms, minus 2 cos theta r hat, doing the gradient formula in spherical coordinates, like in inside back page of Jackson, you can look that up in spherical coordinates if you didn't remember it, and then minus sine theta hat, over r cubed. And so this you can compare with equation 4.12 in Jackson. One interesting thing about this P of x, the result we found for the polarization in the interior of the sphere is that it's constant. reason that's interesting is, remember, we defined the bound charges, rho b, as, let's see, was it negative or positive? Yeah, negative, I think. Minus del dot p. So, what we found in solving this problem is there are no bound charges in the inside that are doing all this. So the only thing doing the actual work of making the dipole are these bound charges on the surface. And the bound charges, sigma b, are found by taking the normal component vector and dotting it into p. So in this case, sigma b is p dot r hat, and that is equal to this 3 epsilon naught, epsilon over epsilon naught minus 1 over epsilon naught plus 2 e naught cos theta. So if theta equals 0, this is a positive number that's in the direction of the z-axis. We have positive charges here, and near theta equals pi, where cos theta is minus 1, we'll have negative charges. And this is setting up this polarization. Okay, one other conclusion, we can draw another interesting conclusion from the same math. If we simply interchange the roles of epsilon and epsilon naught, and then we've treated a very different physical situation, but found some interesting results about it. So let's just imagine now as an aside about the math we've worked out, we could treat a spherical cavity in a medium that is a dielectric everywhere. The epsilon naught, the medium has epsilon. So there's what I like to call Feynman's dictum. Which is a deep statement that the same equations have the same solutions. So we get all the same equations for this different physical situation, just with epsilon and epsilon not changed everywhere. And we can immediately jump to the electric field inside expression, making that change. So now it looks like 3 epsilon over 2 epsilon plus epsilon naught times the electric field at infinity. And now this electric field will be larger than the applied. If the dielectric constant outside is larger than the vacuum inside, which would be the usual case. So let's kind of draw pictures to make kind of a cartoon way to think about what's going on qualitatively. So for our first case, where we have epsilon inside, of our field applied, right? Now, applying the field changes, it makes a polarization inside, constant polarization inside, which is the same everywhere in the material. And it has been induced by the external field. And that in turn led to bound charges, sigma b, on the surface only, which produced an internal electric field in the opposite direction, which caused the field inside to be reduced from what it would be if it was just vacuum everywhere. And for the other situation, for the cavity in the dielectric medium. Okay, so now we have in all space, we have our epsilon, we have our field applied, and then we have our cavity with epsilon naught. Now you should think in the other way that the charge is accumulating, of course, will be in the other direction. It looks more like that. And so now the E inside, in, due to these surface charges, is looking positive and adding to the electric field inside. And just one other aside about this. If you have a homogeneous medium, which means it has an epsilon, which is not changing throughout the medium. It's a constant throughout that whole material. If there are no free charges present, then rho bound, which will be minus del dot p, should vanish, right? And that's because del dot E is rho free over epsilon in the material, which is zero if there are no free charges. And P is epsilon naught times the electric susceptibility times E. So del dot E is zero, so del dot P will be zero if there's no spatial dependence of the this polarizability, which is what is meant by homogeneous. Okay, I think that's all I wanted to say about this boundary value problem. Any more questions or comments about it? Okay. So I've said a few times as we started talking about this more macroscopic application of Maxwell's equations, that it's a little bit difficult or a little bit handicapped by limiting ourselves to classical physics and ignoring the quantum world. But if we really want to understand what an electric field does to atoms, molecules, solids, we need to really be thinking a little bit, at least, about the quantum mechanics. So this, the subject we're going to embark on, which will take us into the next lecture, that I'll get started on today, is discussing the microscopic theory of polarization. Now, classically, you know, before quantum mechanics was there, going back into the 1880s and so on, they could understand quite a bit about it with simplified models and so on. There's something I want to derive. I think I won't get to it till next time, but you might read ahead. It's a kind of a tricky derivation. Something called the Clausius Mohsatti equation, which is an approximate way to think about and even semi-quantitatively calculate dielectric constants, if you like, or polarization. But before I do that, I want to do something that is actually completely rigorous and sound, but it uses quantum mechanics. And basically, we can think of apply a weak electric field to an atom or molecule. More essentially in free space. So there's some weak electric field. You could call that E other, okay, produced by some charges very, very far away from the atom or molecule, producing an electric field near the molecule. And we want to calculate exactly in that scenario the electric dipole moment induced when this field acts on the atom or molecule. This is a straightforward quantum mechanics problem. If you took my quantum course, you would know how to do this, but most of you have probably not been there. I see some in the room who have. But I think most of you have had an undergraduate quantum course. You know how to do, at least know how to do, first order perturbation theory. Which is all we need. First order time independent perturbation theory. So we will do this calculation and we will basically write the answer in this form after we calculate this dipole moment induced by a tiny electric field, small enough that we can apply perturbation theory. And we'll write the dipole moment in, as being proportional, and we'll find out in first order perturbation theory, it is proportional to the applied field. And we'll call gamma molecular is the molecular polarizability and it has dimensions of a length cubed. And one thing we have to be careful of, and this will come up later, especially when we talk about Clausius Mossati, is that this omits the electric field due to the dipole itself. So let me just sketch. I'm going to go through it fairly quickly, but I think it's good to see and maybe connect with your quantum courses that maybe a lot of you are taking, how the calculation goes in the quantum world. Do I have time? I might. So let's kind of specialize to a simple situation, a one electron or one valence electron atom or molecule. Okay. Sodium atom, hydrogen atom, pick your favorite atom. Then the term added, there will be, of course, the H naught before the electric field was applied. It gives the energy levels of the atom or molecule. We'll be especially interested in the ground states that we'll try to assume, like we have this atom or molecule in its ground state. We're applying an electric field to it. And now we'll have another term, H prime, which is our perturbation term. And H prime acting on this will be for an electron. It would be, of course, minus Q E Z, or E dot R, but in this case it would be, we'll direct the field along the Z axis, so the potential, the electric potential is minus E other Z multiplied by the charge on the electron, which is minus E. Makes the whole term look positive. E times E other times Z. Okay. So what you learn in first order perturbation theory is how to write the correction term caused by this H prime. Right. So let's talk about the ground state wave function to first order. It'll have, first of all, the wave function to zeroth order, basically the eigenfunction of H naught with the lowest energy. But then there is the perturbation term, which will be a sum over all other states in the Hilbert space. Psi k, the zeroth order states, multiplied by a matrix element of the H prime. And matrix element of H prime with the ground state. Divided by the difference of the energies of these two zeroth order eigenstates. And once you have that, you can calculate this induced moment, which of course will only have a Z component, as minus the matrix element, basically just the average of the electric dipole operator. The correct first order corrected psi matrix element VE times Z and psi ground. And doing the math, then that quickly you see comes to 2e squared over epsilon naught, sum over all these states other than the ground state, the square of psi k zero z psi ground zero absolute square over that energy difference. And then that multiplies epsilon naught E other. And so by the notation we set up over there, this quantity in parentheses is the quantum way to calculate this molecular polarizability, which is completely general. And that's the microscopic induced electric dipole moment when you apply a field to an isolated atom or molecule. So next time we'll talk about connecting that to the macroscopic world and do the Clausius-Mossadi equation. Sorry, I went over a couple minutes. If any of you didn't get your exam yet, come up here.